I'm wondering how you're doing with this. And I can't see the expressions on your faces. But I hope you're doing good. There's a nice vibe here. I'm really enjoying sitting with you. It feels very precious and fantastic. You know, I just love it. This sort of feeling of shared endeavor, shared hearts. Different ways of talking about this practice. You know, one of the ways would be to say that we're all in recovery from a case of mistaken identity. Or another way would be that this is the next sort of developmental step. This is the next step of our growth. The attraction to this really, you know, really is what does all the work. We go through unbelievable shenanigans on this path. Sometimes the sheer sort of impossibility of it all can be quite intense, I find. Sometimes, you know, from the sort of personal point of view, if I think too much about this practice, I very quickly arrive at a conclusion I'm basically not up for it. So we don't practice from the personal point of view. It's hopeless to do it from that place. We can't bring about our own salvation. We can't create heaven for this body mind or anything permanent in the realm of conditions. We can solve all kinds of sort of external problems, functional conditional problems in our lives, but we can't solve the one problem, the knot in the heart. We can't seem to solve that one through any experience, any means, any endeavor, any strategy, any idea, any knowledge or information, any relationship, any memory, any hope. Any possession, anything that we can get. Doesn't do it. So meditation practice is absolutely not about solving the insolvable problem of the self dilemma, the dilemma of self-confinement, the dilemma of separation and separative consciousness. It is a dilemma. It's the expression of a dilemma. In some ways, you could say it's the perfect expression of a dilemma. It is that. It can't be anything else. To try and make it something else is a lost cause and a waste of energy. So one of the ways that the meditation, this particular path goes, because this is a particular sort of spiritual style, is that it kind of, you know, it wears us down. We kind of set ourselves up foolishly, if you like. You know, we just sort of open ourselves up to conditional existence, but we don't take refuge in anesthetizing ourselves. We stay as bare attention. It is something to have to bear, isn't it? And then we see, you know, the tendencies. We're at the mercy of the tendencies, the egoic tendencies, the tendencies to want to just keep distracting, keep withdrawing, keep seeking consolations, keep resisting what is. Always this recoiling from the truth of this moment. See, and suddenly in meditation practice we have no defense against that anymore. We have to feel what that feels like. It's unbearable. Isn't it? It's unbearable just to feel that for too long. But the grace of the practice is you don't have to. Because if you're courageous enough to open up to yourself and see what you're about, then we bear just the right amount to cause the heart's release. At a certain point, the heart says, "That's it. I've had enough of that." That's it. It just happens quite naturally. Sometimes things have to get very hot for us. There's a paradox there. I mean, it's, you know, it seems that this is a very cooling practice. Calm and cooling, you know, relaxed, sort of Buddhists wouldn't harm a fly kind of number. But actually, there's a great heat, isn't there? There's a great heat to this practice. It's good if you can feel some fire in your belly with this. You know that you're onto something. This practice is not designed to be easy. I didn't put that on the flyer because I thought you wouldn't come. But it is the truth that this is not an easy thing to do. It will take you into a fire. It's a fiery thing. But ironically, there's a quenching or a coolness that comes from going through that. Very often when we start feeling the heat of this practice, in Sanskrit it's called tapas. It literally means heat. The heat of entering into spiritual disciplines. Now, you know, from a kind of unenlightened point of view, we can think, oh, that's, you know, fasting or, you know, lying on a bed of nails or whatever, you know, this idea of Indians who kind of put themselves through all these sort of austerities for the sake of generating tapas. But actually the real fire is what we're doing now. This is the real fire. It's the fire of facing into conditions, facing into the habit or the dilemma that we have adapted ourselves to of separative consciousness, of no longer insulating yourself against the effects of it, but just feeling it and being true to yourself with this. Don't let yourself off the hook. Don't even have a plan. Toss away everything. You know, the meditators who scare me the most are the ones who've got it all worked out and have got a good plan and they're kind of getting there. They're really good at meditation. I don't know what that is. I'm no good at meditation personally. I hope you don't think that I am. I don't seek to be good at meditation. Not as a kind of just a sort of a skill set, you know, meditate, you know, you can sit still without moving, look calm or whatever, I don't know, have the right kind of set of spiritual emotions and not any of the negative stuff. All of that is the ideal, isn't it, from the egoic point of view, the ideal of, you know, of spiritual life. It's nothing like that in reality. It's messy, isn't it? We enter into the fire. It's messy business. It's not reasonable. it's a purification, which really, you know, all you've got to do is just hang in. Just hang in. You don't have to do it. This process will do itself through you. It will use your body mind. This process demands your body mind. That's the sacrifice. This is a sacrificial practice. You offer yourself into this. It's not like you stand on the side and kind of observe from afar. You are the subject. This is about you, as you are, truly. Not as you think you could be or should be or ought to be or want to be or used to be or how somebody else is, but how you really are. So there's a tremendous intimacy to the practice as well. You get to really feel the flavour of this body-mind experience, this being, our tendencies, our arrangements, our fears. You get to the absolute essence of them all the way down to the bottom. You can just stay with it. Just stay conscious. Now, if this was all there was to do, it would be a bit of a sad state of affairs. So I've just kind of given you the total bad news side of it, but there is a real good news side of it as well. You know, basically, there needs to be a something senior to that. Now, this has got nothing to do with age. I've kind of wrote this recently about something, a senior condition or something like that. It sounds like, you know, over 65s or something. What I mean is something which is above that, greater than that. And this is the attraction to the sacred, the heart's longing for truth, the delight of being. The love of the life force itself, free being. There must be an attraction to this, which is the senior condition, or you could say the condition of conditions, or that within which all conditions are hung within the greater context. Infinity itself, becoming referent to infinity, setting the heart on infinity, rather than on the conditional body-mind in time and space as a separate entity. The attraction is what does all the work. It provides the motivating force for this practice to work. There are infinite ways of describing it, and I'm sure if we were to all talk, we would all confess it in a different way. What draws us inwards to the centre of our being? What wakes us up? Our spiritual instinct. This sort of knowing that we have within. Making that more conscious. It's the attraction towards that. Does all the work. It's the new distraction. It's another way of talking about meditation practice. It's the new distraction. We know what all the old distractions were. Something has to distract us away from all of them. There's only one. It has to be something that is senior to all of them, that's powerful enough to distract us away from collapsing into self-concern, into this obsessive involvement with the me story, which is a restless movement within us, that never is a ceaseless kind of restless movement, inherently problematic. Configured as a result of a withdrawal from the real condition of our being, a withdrawal into a sort of private world. And then a kind of a collapse into that, and into the confinement of that. So we're practicing the new distraction. Orientate yourself to the attractive force of truth, or of love, reality, the heart, this moment, your original nature. It calls us, doesn't it? It calls us. If you can feel that, if you let yourself respond, and we're attracted towards truth, and consequently distracted away from our usual concerns and worries. So the amazing thing about spiritual transcendence is we never solved a single problem. We just started practicing something else. Spiritual practice is not based upon the effort to try and solve a problem. The problem cannot be solved in its own terms, in its own domain. If you take the undivided unity of everything, consciousness, the world, the universe, the real condition of reality, and you sort of withdraw from the all of consciousness and cramp awareness down, it's like shoehorning this limitless, infinite consciousness into something limited and tight. Then there's automatically in that a dilemma. We don't do very well in the limit of that. We don't do very well if we make our identity out of the conditions of the body-mind. It never fits. It's too small. It's too limited. And it's inherently problematic, and it's almost like sometimes if I feel, or when I feel the sense of self-confinement, I feel like I'm in a prison, and all I'm doing is reaching around trying to find the key so I can open the door and walk out. That's all I really want to do. I hope that you're hearing me okay with this. I'm not meaning to be down on conditions, you think, you know, or down on the body. There's nothing wrong with, you see, there's nothing wrong with conditions. That's again where we can kind of come unstuck. If we're not very profound about this, we can think, oh, you know, the body's a problem, so therefore, you know, like we can sort of start practicing self-denial. If we think that actually the physical body is the problem, then maybe if I deny the body, don't take care of it, whatever, then I can sort of somehow overcome that problem. Or if we think that our personality is a problem, just having a name or whatever, then we might think I have to stop using my name, or we do something weird or unnatural to try and overcome the personality, or try and sort of kill the ego or something. But there was nothing ever wrong with the body in the first place. There's nothing wrong with the personality. Personality is a beautiful thing. It's an expression, isn't it? It's an expression of something. That's not where the problem is not in the conditions, it's in the relationship with them. It's just that we make our identity out of the conditions, a personal identity. If we are clear enough and we observe the nature of conditions themselves, we'll see that actually they don't invite that. They're changing all the time. They're part of a giant pattern of causes and effects. This body-mind is part of that pattern within nature. Innumerable ways to release out of self-confinement. Getting present. Very common one in meditation circles, body circles, you know, be present, get present. We always think the present moment, that's where it's at, you know. That's what you've got to do. You've got to be present. We can never become present. Ever. So if you ever catch yourself trying to become present, you'll know that you've absolutely lost the plot. Okay? You can never become present. So you have to give that one up completely. It's a subtle one. Doesn't maybe make sense, but it's so. If you try to become present, which seems like a really good idea, and you fail in that, then it produces the learning. Once again, we see, uh-oh, I'm trying to do this from the position of separation. You see, we are present. The truth of our being, our original nature, is presence. We are present. If we recoil from the truth of our being into a separate self, okay, then we're actually, that separate self is based upon a sort of a denial or a collapse away from the present moment. From that position, if we then try to become present, it never works because we're trying from the wrong place. We're actually, what we're doing is we're starting from a place of the presumption of not being present, and from there trying to become present, but it never actually works. You can't do it. You can't do it through an act of will, holding your breath, jumping in the stream, whatever. Because it's all based on an error, a lack of recognition of where we really are. So all efforts at trying to become present fail. And if you're fortunate enough to exhaust yourself in all that trying, you can see that what was that about? Why am I trying? Who is this I that is trying to become present? See, this is where we get right underneath it. Who is this I that is trying to become present? If I confess the I is the one that doesn't want to, that is recoiling from the present moment. Therefore, it's a contradiction in terms. The I is constructed out of a recoil from presence. And yet, in its madness, it wants to be present. It's kind of like wanting to have your cake and eat it. It can't be done. It just can't be done. If you can see that, if you see that whole thing playing out in consciousness, it's just a movement in consciousness, and it's full of emotional energy and identity. Yeah. Then we don't do that. See, don't do that. So now, don't try and become present. Now there's even less of you now. You're one strategy down, you know. Now what are you going to do? See? Now, if you're not mindful, you'll probably come up with another plan. Okay. You can't become present. All right. I have to try something else. See? We're great at that one. This is about the ego wanting to be present at its own funeral, isn't it? That's what it is. I'll try something else. I, the efforting one, will try something else to bring about my great awakening in the present moment so I can fully enjoy it from my personal point of view. See, without realizing that there's a price to pay for presence, and that is your very life. Your very life is the cost. That's what you have to give. That's all you have to give, but it is what you have to give. It's weird. It's like we have to give our life in order to get our life back. When we feel ourselves to be present, we get our life back, our real life. Not this other thing, the madness of the other thing. Our real identity. Nothing was really lost in that process, and yet it can seem like the most agonizing kind of death. Do you ever find that? I mentioned this morning, or no, it was last night, about this practice demands letting go. I don't think I have to tell you. I'm sure you discovered this for yourself. So I find myself sitting from the personal point of view sometimes thinking, I don't want to let go. I don't think it's going to be good for me. That's how it feels. There's nothing in it for me. Why would I want to do it? It's just miserable. That's an expression of the doubt, isn't it? That's doubt, the fifth hindrance working there. It's not actually the truth. This process, by the way, is not a one-shot affair. We kind of come in and out of this a lot in the course of practice. You have moments where you've released, and suddenly, you've recovered. You've recovered your life. Not by doing anything, but by stopping doing something. This almighty distraction or this almighty recoiling from truth. And then, suddenly, full of life. Nothing was lost. I'm still here. I'm still breathing. Some transformation has occurred. Something remarkable. But nothing awful happened. It's worth, reminding ourselves of this. If you find yourself on the edge, and the practice is designed to take you to the edge, where you know that what spirit is demanding from you is to let go. And you think, I really don't want to do this. I don't think it's going to be good for me. Feel the resistance and remind yourself. Trust. The only thing you got to letting go of is the cramp of self-confinement. This tenacious grasp that we have upon personal dilemma. If you can bring all of the wanderings of the mind and all of the wonderful creations of the me world, of what we construct when we dissociate from being, if you can just bring all that down just to the dilemma, just you can just see and more importantly feel the dilemma of it. See that I, the little I, is always in dilemma. Always. It's always there. It's insolvable. It's lost its turanga waiwai. Isn't it? It doesn't know where to stand. It's always looking around for some new experience, something. Inherently disturbed. If you can just notice that, that requires quite a lot of equanimity and simplicity, because normally we take ourselves so seriously. The story of me is huge, it's vast. I could sit here all day and tell you about my life and my problems and my thoughts and this and that, and it goes on and on and on. We haven't got time. One of the functions of the death meditations will be starting tomorrow, shows you haven't got time. The ego, the self-confinement, needs lots of time. Isn't it? Because that's what it ranges around in. The dream of time. We need lots of it. I need lots of it so I can, I need the future. Because I haven't arrived yet. I haven't arrived yet. Therefore, I need the future. That I need a lot of time to complete myself, to get happy. To be finally happy, I need a lot of things. the recollection of death is a reminder, you don't have time. You're going to die. Any time, your death will come. And in that moment, we'll remind you, you don't have time, your time's up. That's great. It's a disaster from the point of view of personal consciousness. It's the worst case scenario. But from a spiritual point of view, believe it or not, we actually welcome that. I don't mean that in some kind of bizarre, like we'll become a suicide cult or something. But in terms of the sort of sacred charge of death, life and death, it's a great wake up there. It's full of energy, luminous. It reveals to us what the truth has been all along. This body's not yours. Don't take possession of it. It doesn't belong to you. Death will show us that. Everything. And it's the end of time from this personal body-mind point of view. Now generally, because we're so wedded and entangled in time and space and me and body-mind and conditions and hopelessly lost in all of that, we need to wake ourselves up. Things are going to wake us up out of that. Recollection of death is really useful for that. Just get over it. You've got to get over yourself. Wake up now. This is all you've got. You don't have plenty of time. So in this moment, make your one response from the heart. Live that. An act of faith. We get to rehearse this in meditation. You get plenty of opportunities here just to keep living this. Find out just like familiarize yourself with it. Feel what it's like, what spiritual practice is like, practicing spirit, the spirit response to this moment, to live that. Not as a solution to a problem, okay, but as something, an utterly different orientation. It's like the problem of me is still there. We could go to it at any time. If you collapse your attention and go towards your personal story, I guarantee to you that you will find it will all be there waiting for you, just how it was. Just how it was. With the same limitations, the same dilemmas, the same whatever you inherited from mum and dad and all the rest of it, the conditions of nature. See, there it is. We don't practice that. We're distracted away from that by something senior, something greater, something more attractive. The attraction primarily is in the heart. So we lead from the heart in this practice, even though it's called insight meditation, it's not really primarily at this center. It's the heart, the movement of the heart that draws us in. But this particular meditation is one that combines them both, so that as you're drawn forward, you also bring great clarity to that. So you see, because it's very easy to be deluded. Yeah, that's the thing. We can get fooled very easily. We fool ourselves.